Welcome to Hochoka Podcast.
What do an impromptu visit to a friend's house, a pickup basketball game, going on an out-of-state trip, or cultural activities have to do with a healthy residential environment for kids? We're about to find out. Hello, Mataki Epi. Welcome to Hochoka, here at the St. Joseph's Indian Schools campus. I'm Scott Wooster, your Hochoka host. We're glad you've joined our circle with Don Forrester, Executive Director of the Coalition of Residential Excellence, more commonly known as CORE. Don is in town because St. Joseph's Indian School is a CORE member and is the host for this year's National CORE Conference here on the banks of the Missouri River. We are taking this opportunity to get to know Don and CORE and the work they do on behalf of residential programs throughout the country. Don, a warm Hochoka welcome to you.
Thanks, Scott. We are delighted to be here.
So let's talk about you. I'm getting to know you here today.
Okay.
And you told me, I believe, off screen that you worked for 46 years directly with children?
I started to work as a child protective services worker in 1970.
Okay.
If you do the math, I've been involved in this for a very, very long time, and
right.
I absolutely love it.
Right.
I actually was in graduate school preparing myself, hopefully, for a career as a pastor of a church.
Okay.
And I got my draft notice.
Okay.
Was not expecting that. So dropped out of school. My wife and I moved back to our hometown thinking she would stay with her folks while I was in basic training. And then I failed the physical. Have a right bundle branch block instead of going pitter-patter. My heart goes patter-pit.
Yep.
And that kept me out of the military. So I'm out of school. I don't have a job. Have no idea what I'm going to do with my life. And I thought, you know what I really need to do is go to work.
Yeah.
And so I went to the state unemployment agency, and they suggested that I take a merit test to consider working for the Department of Public Welfare.
Okay.
And so I began work as a child protective services worker.
Okay.
And within 3 months, I knew I had found my life's calling.
Wow.
It was the most meaningful thing I'd ever done. I thought, this is real ministry.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
There were days I'd reflect on the day and think, you know, somehow in the course of the day, I made a difference in the life of a child or in the life of a family from a hard place.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I haven't tired of it yet. It energizes me.
Yeah.
I moved over into residential child care licensing, working with places like St. Joe or children's homes. And it, too, was protective services. You just regulated licensing requirements, did investigations, and spent 17 and a half years doing that. I guess it was a midlife crisis because I may have been midlife by then, but yeah. I wanted hands-on experience.
Right.
So I accepted a position at a children's home as a director, and we had group care for kids, we had foster care, we had adoption, and we had counseling. And so I spent the next 26 and a half years involved in that. And one of the things I like about working with the Coalition of Residential Excellence is I get to interact with people who have that same love.
Right.
And it keeps me peripherally involved.
Yeah. Yeah. So I am trying to do math over here. So I'm trying to sort out the 26s and the 17s and all that. But you dedicated a life you intended to go in as a pastor because you cared and it was something you wanted to do.
Interestingly, it just fell in my lap, but I had the chance then to pastor a small rural church.
Okay.
And they have a reputation for being patient and long-suffering. I pastored that church for 42 years.
Wow. Okay.
And I still go there. I just moved from the pulpit to the pew about a year and a half ago.
Wow. So you did get to live that part of that dream as well.
It was therapy for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
But my first love is helping kids and families from hard places.
Absolutely. And if you were a child welfare worker in the 70s, Why did they point you in that direction? You walked into the unemployment office and they said, hey.
I told them I want a job helping people.
Okay, yep.
You know,
simple as
they
that.
suggested the Department of Public Safety. I didn't want to be a highway patrolman.
Right.
I'd much prefer to work with kids and families.
Yeah, and they sent you in the right direction, one that changed your life.
I could not believe how meaningful it was.
Yeah.
It met my needs, so.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So what did that look like when you were doing the on the streets work when you started out as a young guy, I assume in your 20s at some point, you know?
I was 20, I don't know how old I was, 23?
Yeah, right.
I was eager to know how to do the job. Yeah, At some point, I thought, you know, I'd have a perfect job if I were the supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
That was stupid.
Yeah.
Because then I was a supervisor and have never been more miserable in my life.
Right.
That's when I moved from direct working with protective services into residential child care licensing.
Yeah. What does it look like, the work that you do as the director for that at this point?
Well, we try to support one another, and I will say the Coalition of Residential Excellence has the most gifted, talented, professional people I've ever worked with. We have an annual conference every year. I'm amazed at the new information.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I this morning I wrote down as this was, you know, the last half day, and I wrote down the name A.J. Jacobs on a piece of paper, thinking I'm going to have time to talk. He wrote a book, Living Biblically, A Year of Living Biblically, and he's Jewish.
Okay.
And he said, to say that I'm Jewish is like saying the Olive Garden is an Italian food restaurant.
Right.
Not very.
Right. Yeah.
But he said it changed his life.
Yeah.
He later read the Encyclopedia Britannica and wrote a book called The Know-It-All.
Okay.
Well, I've been involved in this work forever. I don't know it all.
Yeah.
And no one knows it all
because
best practice is constantly changing.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of did an inventory of all the presentations that have been made this week.
Mm-hmm.
If I were going to miss one, what would I pick?
Right.
I couldn't pick one out.
Right.
All of them had new information.
Yeah.
Everybody comes to the core conference and they leave with takeaways of how they can improve their program by just simply integrating what somebody else is doing.
Right.
And so core has a process that people have questions. You know, I send the questions out, take the answers and distribute them.
Yeah.
People share what they've got and what works for them.
Mm-hmm. And they're learning, I would assume, from the kids that they work with, too. So all the people that come to the CORE conference have just spent the last year learning from the actual children who the program serve, and they're our best teachers, correct?
Exactly. Well, and plus, best practice changes. When I started to work, the first information share with me, if a foster parent ever says they want to adopt a child, move the child. Well, now it's the first resource that people look at if there's not family available. The kid already is bonded with the family.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you disturb that?
Right, yeah.
Sometimes we're slow to connect the dots.
We are, for sure, yeah. So I if somebody didn't have an understanding of CORE, you're the head of it now. What's the history of it? How long has it been around?
Under a different organizational structure and name, it was a program exclusively for residential schools.
Okay.
You know, we now go under residential excellence, and we include both schools and children's homes.
Okay.
Because there are many, many similarities between the two structures.
Yeah.
Of course, kids come into an academic setting primarily for the education, but you then, because they reside on campus, need to provide the nurture, support, and supervision. So you're caring for their kids. People placing children with us in children's homes, for a number of reasons, the child can't stay in the setting in which they are. I mean, there are multiple reasons, I won't go into it, but we then, because we understand the importance of education, use the public school for kids. So our working with kids is very, very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And the challenges are similar.
Okay. Yeah. And how many How many residential organizations are
currently there? Are 39 wow. core members.
Wow. Okay. I'm going to ask you a question that's a little involved, so I'm going to take it straight from my script here. But you do a great deal of advocacy on behalf of children in Washington, D.C., many of who are growing up in a family care model, cottage family care model. At St. Joe's, the mix of family environments is a little bit different from that. So our student profile data indicates these statistics.
Okay.
So 9% of current students here at St. Joe's come from two-parent homes, 48% from one-parent or one-caregiver homes, 24% live with grandparents, 13 are in adoptive or guardianship environments. A handful might be involved with DSS or Department of Social Services. And depending on the year, all those numbers will fluctuate.
Sure.
You understand that, of course. But it is always a parent or guardian that enrolls their child in this school, guardian being DSS.
Sure.
We're a home away from home for about 200 students, roughly grades 1 through 12. Where our school and your work intersect is at the crossroads of a childhood development and the advocacy for their environment they need to become healthy adults as we care for them in a residential setting. So you're a big advocate, you do the advocacy piece. 2021, you write a white paper called The Unseen Crisis, okay? And you write about those ingredients that make up the recipe for a successful development.
Okay.
Can you talk about that?
Before you answer that question, let me back up to the demographics or the breakdown of children.
Perfect.
Because what you just described could be found on almost any children's home campus.
Okay.
It's the same population.
Yeah.
Children's homes, you know, don't take custody of children. The parent or managing conservator places the child in the children's home.
It.
So, you know, 40 years ago, it was different.
Yeah, for sure. So what do you see how would I want to reflect on the unseen crisis and how you see that as making up a...
Well, I think the things that are important for kids and part of what you can find in a cottage family home model is a house parent couple who have the wherewithal to devote their time to support children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in contrast to a foster care home, and I am a foster care advocate, but most foster parents, at least one of them, works outside the home. Sometimes mm-hmm. they both do.
Right.
And a cottage family home model, the job is simply being available to support kids.
Mm-hmm.
And so consequently, children in our care, just like on St. Joe's, have a multiple of opportunities to be involved in extracurricular activities.
Yeah.
You know, we support anything the school does, whether it's sports, band, drama, whatever. We want our kids to take full advantage of it. We also want kids to have a sense of community.
Yeah.
You know, through church, through whatever's available within the framework of the community, we want them to have the same kind of experiences that a child in their own home would have.
Right, right. And here I reflect that back to what we do at St. Joe's in the 1970s. We had 100 young men were all cotted up in one floor, you know, with 3-4 adult men watching over the whole group in just one big room. And we made the move at the end of the 70s to go to the cottage would be a good
cottage. It's very similar to a children's home.
Yeah.
But, you know, many, many years ago, even children's homes had many more kids in a cottage than they do today.
Right. And now there are more reasonable ratios for adults to kids. You know, I think even if I read it right, in The Unseen Crisis, I think you had talked about 1 to 6 or something along those lines. Maybe.
Most places are 1 to 8. Some are 1 to 10 to 12. But for the most part, it's not a large group of kids.
Right.
But the place that I went to back, 40 years ago, they were employing single moms who may be in their mid-60s caring for 25 kids.
Right.
I don't know how you balance it, but...
No.
And the thing that both of our organizations have is a check and balance system.
Mm-hmm.
There are many people that children interact with. If there's something amiss, they've got someone to talk to.
Right.
We also, do surveys of kids. We do training around abusive children. We want to be the first people to know if there is anything that seems out of order.
Absolutely.
And, in other kinds of settings, you don't have that level of accountability.
I agree. I'm thinking, or what I'm hearing and seeing through your writing, is that you're advocating through lawmakers, too, to make sensible laws that
a new law, the Family First Prevention Services Act,
mm-hmm.
was passed in 2018. It was added on to a must-pass budget bill.
Okay.
But it transformed what was seen as acceptable.
Okay.
They're billing that act as a 21st century child welfare program.
Okay.
They see what we do as being old school, removing children from their families because of abuse or neglect.
Mm-hmm.
And so under the Family First Prevention Services Act, if the level of abuse or neglect was such that a child could legally be removed from the family,
mm-hmm.
There was the option to provide wraparound services for that family.
Okay.
And when that can help, I would applaud that.
Yeah.
But the issue today, and so they prohibited the use of 4E money for anything. Well, I think there's a 10-day period that the state could pay with federal funds in a children's home setting, but that's it,
mm-hmm.
unless the child had severe behavioral or emotional disturbance. For kids who don't need treatment services, they have to be placed in a foster family home,
mm-hmm.
which is 6 or fewer children in most states, in order to get funding. So in essence, children's homes, residential schools were taken away from the continuum of care for children.
Okay. Yeah.
And, there is currently a bill, H.R. 3852, create accountable, respectful environments care, mm-hmm. for children act.
Mm-hmm.
And that would put us back into the kingdom of care.
Yeah.
But those who are supporting the 21st century child protective program say that what we're doing is, they're making allegations that children are denied age-appropriate privileges.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like an Oliver Twist story. And that's not the reality that I've observed.
Right, right.
And most states have licensing programs. And some of the denigrating things that have been said about what's taking place in our country could not happen or coexist if that were true.
Right. Right.
But it's an issue that needs to be resolved. But currently, states were given up to a 3-year period that they could ask for a waiver from that law.
Okay.
That expired October 1st of 21. Since that time, there have been numerous news stories of children who spend the night in CPS offices or in hotel rooms.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from Texas. Let me give you a Texas nightmare. I was shocked recently to read in the Dallas Morning News that over the past 18 months, Texas has spent almost $30 million hiring off-duty policemen to set with kids in hospital and hotels are in makeshift shelters, are in unlicensed facilities. There's no place to put these kids. I mean, it's an issue in many, many places.
Mm-hmm.
And folks who continue to support the 21st century child welfare approach say we haven't given it enough time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
that just doesn't seem right for the kids who don't have a place to be.
So what I hear you saying is that the law basically takes away some opportunities that these kids would have and forces them to maybe have no opportunities.
Sadly, that's true.
Yeah.
There have been a number of cases that the risk was such that the kids were removed. They were placed in unlicensed facilities, where they're more apt to sustain injury or lack of supervision or people caring for them who don't have the training to know how to care for them.
Right. I like to think that our kids are getting just some very amazing services that allow them to be kids, which is what we want.
Scott, that's exactly what we want for kids. We want them to have a normal childhood.
Yeah.
We want them to have the ability to live impromptu.
Yeah.
That they can do things when they're old enough and responsible enough that doesn't require adult supervision.
Right.
We
right.
want them to have the privilege of being kids.
Yeah. And to be developmentally appropriate, right?
Absolutely.
And you said it off air, too. You said, and have the opportunity to make mistakes and to learn from them, too, with an environment that will catch
them. Absolutely. You learn from your mistakes.
Yeah.
We can't wrap kids in bubble wrap. Mm-hmm. They're going to make mistakes.
Yeah.
But they're going to learn from them.
Absolutely. And we're here to guide them and to make sure that they do learn from them and to make sure that they're not shamed when they do make their mistakes.
Absolutely.
And I think we have to be careful so that the folks that we have watching kids in cottages or as house parents don't replace the parents. I mean, that would be kind of a patriarchal or paternalistic sort of...
It is clearly our intent not to replace parents,
right?
Because children need their families.
Mm-hmm.
You said yourself, parents place their children here for an education.
Yeah.
You're going to be talking with the family, being in contact with family having contact with kids. If we don't serve the family, we don't really serve the child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, that's critical.
The partnership with the parents is crucial. They're team members and the most
it's
vital team
like
members.
It's more like co-parenting.
Yeah, yeah.
There are a number of reasons that kids come into care.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the parents incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the 80s, Daniel Yankovich, psychologist, wrote Searching for Self-Fulfillment in a World Turned Upside Down.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about at one time in our country, the best interests of the family seemed to be the principle that people looked at.
Right.
But he says we have developed to a place that people refuse to deny themselves anything on the strange moral principle, I have a duty to myself.
Mm-hmm.
So you have parents who walk away from that responsibility to the way they'd walk away from caring for an animal.
Yeah.
You've got grandparents caring for kids.
Right. Right.
And that really messes up the role of being a grandparent because they have to be the parent.
Right. And in our case, especially, some of that difficulty being a parent comes from generational trauma, carrying some things around that were passed down. And I think it's always important when we include the parents that we treat them, no matter what their state in life at a particular point, with dignity and with caring and,
oh, absolutely.
And as a member.
Sometimes, alcoholism, drug abuse, mm-hmm. render parents not in a place where they can make real responsible choices for kids.
Right.
I'm not suggesting there not be contact, but there may need to be some parameters around the contact.
Yep.
But at the end of the day, the parent still has a prerogative of removing the child if they choose to.
Right, exactly. Yep. We would expect that a child with trauma would be treated in a non-shameful way, in the best way to be treated, and we'll do the same with the parents.
Scott, we know so much more today than we did when you and I started in this business.
Sure.
The impact of trauma on brain development and synaptic connections.
Yeah.
In infancy, a child cries because they're either hungry or they're wet.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what if no one shows up to address either? They lose their voice. Mm-hmm. But they also learn that the adults can't be trusted to care for them.
Right. Right.
We also know that felt safety is as important as real-face mm-hmm. safety. Mm-hmm. If kids have the sense that the wheels are coming off the wagon, even if we know that's not true, they're going to have the same hardwired connection yep. response with cortisol and different chemicals flooding in that put them on high alert.
Yeah. It's real to them, for
sure. It is real to them. And we now know that kids who've been subjected to chronic trauma don't have the cognitive awareness to even process much of what's being asked of them.
Right.
And so when we look at kids differently and see that they're not being oppositionally defiant, but they need some help in understanding, it gives us better tools to relate to them.
We have to change our approach, for sure. Yeah, I agree. So, Don, I just met you today, but I just want to say to you that you've shared your life and continue to make sure that kids are taken care of. Make sure that they have good and healthy and as you said, normal lives. And so I just want to say for what it means to you, Wopila, which is a kind of a way of saying it's a sacred thank you in the Lakota way, just to say Wopila to you for giving your life to this and for continuing to.
Scott, thanks, but I'm the one who's benefited most.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you understand that because you've been in it. Absolutely. And I just want to say thank you for sharing
right.
with
it
us.
It shouldn't too. Hurt to be a child.
It should never hurt to be a child. Yep, I agree. I agree. So thankful.
Thank
thankful
you.
For what you've done. And thanks for joining me here at Ho-Choka, too, and just sharing some
I'm
of this
honored
stuff.
To have had the privilege. Thank you.
Excellent. And we'd like to thank our viewers, too, for joining us here at Ho-Choka at the center of St. Joseph's Indian School, where we talk about issues that are central to Native American education. Until next time, stay centered.